Welcome to the Music Lobby. I'm Bill Hochberg, and on this episode, the British are coming. The British are coming! The British are coming! One if by land, two if by sea, three if by Zoom call. Yes, they're coming for our songwriters, or at least their songwriters' affiliations with performing rights organizations like ASCAP and BMI, and we'll get all into that and what performing rights are and why they're so important. So first we'll interrogate our visitors. Martin McGuire, the head of business development at PRS for Music, based out of London, which is similar to ASCAP and BMI in the US, but also very different. And that's going to be worth explaining. And we'll also be talking with Lance Phillips of Sheridan's, one of the very finest British entertainment firms, where he's a partner in music, digital media, and interactive. Now, you'll notice that they're not wearing red coats, but don't be fooled. And I'm wearing a reddish-orange shirt. Don't anybody shoot me, okay? I'm just the messenger. So we're going to start out with a little interrogation. How is it that they got to where they are today within the British and the world music industry? Martin, let's start with you.
Well, as I'm here with two esteemed lawyers, I'll start off by saying I started my career in the music industry on pirate radio at the age of 14.
We caught up with you in the end, Martin. We got you in the end. It took a while, but we got you.
Well, I've gone from breaking license.
Can you tell us the name of the call letters of the pirate radio? Was it on a ship? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
It wasn't on a ship. No, it was. I'm not that old. So it was in the days where it moved into council estates in London. And then moved into DJing in nightclubs, also probably illegally by the age of 15. Then went to study music production at college at 16. And one of our tutors told us, if you want to make any money in this business, you need to study the music business. So I went to university at 18 and studied music industry management and marketing, and then left and did a year at Barclays. Not entirely sure why, but quite quickly realized that banking wasn't in my future, and landed at PRS, and I've been there for now 17 and a half years.
Fantastic. Lance, can you tell us a bit about you and your journey?
Yeah, I started as a tea boy in a recording studio and spent a year making tea and got very good at it, actually. But whilst I was doing that, this was back in the mid-80s, in a time before Brit schools and schools for performing arts and all kinds of organized courses and learning how to be a recording engineer. So when I started, you learned by being a tea boy, and then you were allowed to sit in the studio, watch what happened and how microphones were placed and what buttons did what and what faders did what and what cables did what. And then you progressed to a tape operator, as it used to be called back in the days when we had tape machines. And then I became an assistant engineer and eventually a recording engineer, and I ended up working at Air Studios, which is George Martin Studios, back in the early to mid 90s. Then went freelance, did a little bit of management, ran what we laughingly called a record company for a while, which was a lot of fun, but we might just as easily put a whole bunch of fibers in a suitcase and set it on fire. And then decided at the rather a ripe old age of 30 or something that I should probably settle down and get a steady job. So I went back to college part-time, 4 years, did a law conversion degree, and then found my way into the legal industry. And I've been at Sheridan's now since 2005.
Oh, wonderful. And, you know, there's so much we could talk about here about on so many different topics, but we're narrowing it down to performing rights societies and performing rights. And could one of you tell us what the heck is performing rights and where does it come from? Or shall I have that task? Anybody? Martin,
this is your area, I think.
Yeah, I certainly pick this up. So in the UK, the performing right, in the context of the Copyright Designs and Patents Act 1988, which is the CDPA, refers to the exclusive right of the copyright owner to authorise the public performance of a work. It's often onward assigned to a performing rights organisation and or a publisher, and then licences are issued to allow businesses and individuals to play music in public, which includes live and recorded music, broadcasts on TVs, radios and the such in cafes and offices, etc. And that ensures that songwriters, composers and publishers are paid fairly for their royalties when their music is used.
Your work deserves more than attention. It deserves protection. Raines is trusted by artists, producers, and creatives across the industry. With offices in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, and beyond, we bring sharp legal thinking to litigation, business, real estate, and private client matters, protecting tomorrow and delivering today. We've got you. Raines.
So, and it's similar in the US. We have ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, and Global Music Rights, which, full disclosure, our firm does some work for Global Music Rights. It's a smaller, more exclusive one. The CSAC is also a, I think it's more of an invite only, whereas BMI and ASCAP is open to all comers. And these are, what are they? They're collecting for what we call public performance. Sometimes it's called communication rights, but we call it public performance. And that means anywhere that you hear music. If you're in a restaurant, you hear music. If you're at a venue, you hear music. If you're on the listening to the radio, streaming, you name it. If it's playing, then there's performing rights involved. And that goes back to really the first time that there was recorded music, probably. Well, it doesn't go all the way back to the player piano, which was in like 1909, but that's a different rabbit hole that we could get down. But it does go back. ASCAP and BMI are governed by a consent decree, and the others are not. The other two are not. But we have a public performance right, and it's a very large portion of the income of a songwriter, not of a performer. Can you talk a little bit about that? How big of a part of a songwriter's income or a publisher's income is performing rights compared to, say, other aspects of the publishing business?
The performing rights themselves, when we look at the rights that are in, or vested in a songwriter and a publisher, there's obviously the mechanical right as well. And I guess in the UK, the mechanical right is the exclusive right of a musical work's copyright owner to authorize the reproduction and copying of a work into a physical or digital format. So when we look at royalties paid through at a proportion of income. MIDiA did a report, I think, in 2021, and they estimated that for a performing songwriter, publishing income represents about 10% of their total income streams. However, for a non-published, non-performing songwriter, it could be up to 100% of their revenue streams. And for a published non-performing songwriter, the performing element itself is probably around 25% of their income stream.
So most of the money is what we call performing rights income and also mechanical income, which we'll talk about what that is. And for streaming, which is such a big part of the music industry right now, there's a component. There's income generated for the creative people and the companies there. So, but you have a record royalty that goes to the label and the artist, and then you have a publishing part of it, which is for the songwriter and the publishing company. And they're very di and they're different. So nowadays, it used to be like Elvis and Frank Sinatra didn't write any of their music. Maybe once in a while they didn't. They had songwriters come and do that. Nowadays, you have people like Justin Bieber, not known as a songwriter, but you will see his name, and other pop writers will have their name on a song. The joke, and there might be 12 other writers or five other writers, and the joke that you sometimes hear is write a word and get a third. If you are in the room, and so there's this desire to be a songwriter, but it is a completely different thing. And as you said, Martin, it's like if you're a songwriter, this kind of income, this performing rights income, is a huge part, 70 or 80% of your income.
I think just picking up on Martin's point there, that those are interesting numbers, Martin, that actually they're a little higher than I'd thought. But I think the other thing about performing income, if you're a songwriter, whether you're a performing writer or a non-performing writer, I mean, providing that you have a reasonable catalogue, is it's consistent income. It's always going to be there. Other forms of income that songwriters can earn, synchronization fees if their songs get used in films, TVs and games, mechanical royalties if they make, if an album or its recording is made, can spike. An album can be made and sell nothing. An album can be made and sell millions. Synchronization fees can vary from, I mean, I've seen, you know, low hundreds to seven figure numbers, but they're not necessarily a consistent earner. Whereas a performance income for a successful songwriter is a bedrock. So you sort of say 25%, and some people might think, well, that's not much, but that's 25% you're going to get year in, year out. And as you say, Martin, sometimes that's actually 100% of everything you're going to get, and sometimes it's a little less. So it's important to have it because it's always going to be there.
And so, yeah, the three big forms of income for a songwriter and a music publisher is this performance income that we're talking about, mechanical income, which we'll explain a little more, and sync, which you just said, Lance, about sync. And what is sync? That is actually synchronizing what?
Yeah, so synchronizing is where you take a song and a recording of that song. And you, as you've explained, Bill, they're two separate things. And it's then copied into the soundtrack of a film or a television program or an advert or a game into an audiovisual production. And it's used as a term of art in the UK. Actually, at law, there is no such thing as a synchronization right. It doesn't exist. It's not mentioned in the CDPA. What you need a license for is you are making a copy of that song and you are making a copy of that recording to put into the soundtrack, which is then embedded in the audiovisual production game. Whatever it is. So if you're making a film and you want to use, let's say, a Beatles track, well, firstly, I wouldn't bother because you won't get consent, but let's assume that Sir Paul's woken up one day and he's feeling generous. You need to go and get the rights to use the Beatles recording in that film, and you have to pay a fee for that, which will be significant. And then you need to go and get the rights to use the song that's on that recording in the film as well, which you will get from the songwriter and or his publisher. And that will be an equivalent fee as well. So those fees can be significant.
Yeah.
They can be seven figures. They can be much less depending upon the production, the budget, how it may be. So they're good to get, and good publishers will work really hard to try and get them. And they can be a significant earner. Yeah.
You mentioned a very important word, consent.
Yeah.
Okay, and that means that you've got to ask if you want to take a song and use it in a visual.
Absolutely.
But if it's audio only, Martin, you don't need consent, right? They have these things called blanket licenses. So if you're just using the song audio only, it's not. But if you're using a sync, which is again like the kitchen sink, and everybody has a story about the worst sync that they ever heard of. And the worst one I ever heard of was actually for an Irish bank that was doing a commercial, and they were using the song Don't Stop Believing, and it was a talking toilet for some reason. It was a toilet that was singing the song Don't Stop Relieving, I guess is what it was. And it actually, when it got back to, and it wasn't used with proper consent, and it got taken down because it was not permitted.
I think my favorite one, which I think was approved, was Johnny Cash's version of Ring of Fire, which was used for a hemorrhoid treatment.
Must have been the same.
And I think that's great. And I like to think that he himself gave his consent to that. Whether he did, I don't know. But I like to think he did because he saw the joke.
Must have been the same ad agency.
Sick
ad agency.
Yeah.
But Martin, what about this issue of consent with just purely with performing rights? Do you need, if you're a ad agency, do you need to get consent if it's audio only?
So PRS for Music is the company that effectively runs PRS, the Performing Rights Society, and also acts as a service provider to MCPS, the Mechanical Copyright Protection Society. And in that, we issue joint licenses. So for certain broadcasters, such as the national broadcaster in the UK, the BBC, we issue what's called a blanket license. And that covers both their television broadcasts, their radio broadcast, and their on-demand broadcast as well. And what we issue in those instances is what's referred to as a blanket license. And that gives the broadcaster carte blanche to be able to use whatever works they want to within our repertoire, within their programming, be that visual or audio. The synchronization right normally originates from the mechanical rights organization. And in some of those instances, the publishers enable MCPS to allow those synchronization rights to flow into those blanket licenses. So, in the example of the BBC, the synchronization right is included in their blanket license.
So now,
It comes back to the question of consent and whether or not someone wants their work used. So there are mechanisms within those blanket licenses. One's called a prior approval. So if you have particularly sensitive work, or if you are a writer or publisher and you don't want your works used in particular sorts of programming, you can put your work on the prior approval list, which means the broadcaster has to ask permission before they can use it in a particular work, and that permission can be refused. But in some instances, when there's an independent production company that's looking to use works, there's also an exclusion list for independent publishing company or independent production companies as well. So that enables the writers and publishers to maintain that consent when there is a blanket license issued.
but it's good. You have four major broadcasters in the UK, right? BBC One, Two, ITV, and Channel Four, right?
And
Isn't it?
there is a fifth one that I guess to Lance and I feels quite new, but actually is probably about 25 to 30 years old now, which is Channel 5.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's so these blanket licenses that include syncs to a certain extent are with those five pretty much, but not for like as independent companies and so forth that are coming around.
Well, some of them have programs that are commissioned, and an independent production company effectively produces those shows on request for those broadcasters. So they may have a slightly different license type than the blanket with the BBC.
Martin, just for my own information, do the major streaming platforms have blanket licenses, or is there any movement to get them onto blanket licenses, the Netflixes and the Apple TVs of this world, or do they have to come to you on a per project basis?
It's a good question. So, and it depends on what we deem a blanket. So, in the terms the BBC sense, we say blanket when it includes the synchronization right. But there are other blanket licenses that we issue that don't have the synchronization right, but will have the performing and mechanical right flowing into them. So, it still gives you access, but then you would have to go through and pay. So, the typically what we refer to as the GEOL services, and the SVOD services. They typically wouldn't have a blanket. So we've all heard the tale of the synchronization into Stranger Things, of running up that hill, and I think that's widely reported around the fees that were paid and how that was pitched into Netflix. So typically no, but then there are
Can
streaming
you
services such as the
flesh that
BBC's
out
that we.
for those people that may not know that Stranger Things example?
It's been a while since I read the story, but as soon as I think season five is upon us, I believe. I think it was
In
Sony.
general terms, not too specifically, but just generally.
It was a Sony pitch that went into Stranger Things. I think they had the brief, and they felt that Kate Bush's running up that hill would fit perfectly into that brief. And I think they pitched it pretty hard from what I remember from the article, and it ended up landing. But that became sort of the pivotal moment of that season, and it had an incredible impact on Kate Bush's streaming. I mean, Kate Bush continues to stream incredibly well, regardless of that. But I think there were significant spikes in her streaming numbers as soon as that episode launched, because it exposed that song to a generation of people that probably wouldn't have heard it before and then wouldn't have known where to source it. And I think, yeah, it had a massive impact on all income streams therefore.
Okay. Now, back onto the issue of consent. You have to get consent in many cases, in all cases in the US, if you're going to be, well, not all, but almost all cases in the US, if you're going to be pairing visuals with music. One case where you don't is if, apparently, if you're a politician and you have a blanket license, a nice warm blanket, the venue pays for that. But let's say that a politician is walking out to the microphone and has a song playing. They have a blanket license. They're not filming it, but if it's a major politician, billions of people are watching it on news channels, right? But they didn't sync. It's not them who's it's a nice little loophole because they didn't sync that. And I'm not going to take a political party. It happens on both. I mean, it was like Elizabeth Warren did it, Trump, of course, famous for doing it, and saying, we didn't sync it. We have a blanket license. It allows us to play whatever we want in that venue. We're walking out to the mic and we have, here comes the sun or whatever it is while it's coming, while we're coming out, or Eye of the Tiger, whatever. We didn't sync that. But darn it, it's billions of people are watching it on TV. Now, sometimes it's a problem because these ASCAP and BMI have these blanket licenses that are quite broad, and artists don't like that. Others like not so much. Does PRS have a thing where you can opt out if it's going to be used for political, if a politician is using it, music? If you have a blanket license, audio only.
If it were blanket audio only and there was no synchronization, right, there isn't a mechanism specifically to withdraw for political party
Okay.
usage. However, under our articles, there are several different right types that you can withdraw, one of them being the public performance right. So if you were a songwriter and you became aware that a political party were intending on using your work, you could withdraw that right. Which would mean the rights don't flow into any licenses, which would mean that if said political party used it, they would be in breach, which would mean that you could then potentially bring a lawsuit against them. But as it stands, there's nothing to enable you to pull something out specifically for a political party usage.
So we touched on what mechanical rights are, and that's one of the things when I have a young, like someone right out of law school that comes to the office, or wants to intern, or somebody's applying for a job. My question to them, and they want to be in the music law area, I say, what is a mechanical? And I get the most creative because at law school they teach you to fake it till you make it. If you don't know the answer, and I get the most creative answers about what is it has to do with, and sometimes it's right. I mean, it has to do with mechanical operations of, well, what is a mechanical license? It's an odd name for a license. Doesn't it go back to the player piano rolls? My understanding is that there were these companies in the early 1900s in America that had the piano play. They made player pianos, which were really a big deal, and they got exclusives on songs. You can only buy our piano if you want to use that piano roll, and the piano roll would only work on their piano. Well, that turned into like an early antitrust type of a case, and their competitors were able to enact the compulsory license now, so that after you have a first shot at it, anybody can have it. And they had to make piano rolls that worked on any instrument. So fast forward to now, and we still call it a mechanical, but it's in streaming. It's like, and it's typically a mechanical license is a license to sell. I mean, a license to buy something, you're buying something. And yet, oddly enough, it's a big component of streaming, where it's not clearly a purchase when somebody streams something. But isn't it like half of the publisher's portion of the income from streaming music is half of that publisher's portion is roughly half considered performance income and half of it is considered mechanical income. Is that correct?
Okay, quite a lot to unpick there. Martin, I'll have a go, but you leap in. So let's go back to what the mechanical is. I think your example, Bill, of the piano player is a very good one, because that was probably the first example of someone being able to record a composition in a fixed format. And it literally was card with holes punched in it that would trip hammers that would then play the strings on the piano. And so you didn't need a player, it was happening mechanically. And so at this point in history, which I think is probably early 19th century, public performance of music was well established. You go to a concert.
Oh, was it early 20? You mean the early 1900s?
Yeah, early 1900s, sorry, yeah. So public performance is well established. You'd go to a concert hall, Royal Albert Hall, Wigmore Hall, whatever it may be, and you would hear music being performed. In fact, probably, unless you played music yourself in your own home, that was the only way you'd be exposed to music. There was no cinema, there was no radio, there was no record industry. And so there was a method of hearing music, public performance, for which licenses were paid. And then someone came up with this fantastic idea where, well, actually, I can record that composition onto some card with holes, which means it can be played in your home, so it's not a public performance, and not by you. At which point composers turned around and said, well, hang on a minute. This stuff's flying off the shelves, and we're not getting paid any money. And so that's the genesis of what the mechanical royalty is. And fundamentally, I understand it to be, if you are going to make a recording of a song, a mechanical reproduction of that song, whether that's card on a piano, a 78, a 45, a 33 RPM vinyl record, a cassette, a mini disc, a CD, a DVD, a CD-ROM, a download or streaming. They are all mechanical recordings of a song reproductions. Then you have to pay a royalty to the owner of the song, or usually their publisher. And it's done by and large on a per unit basis. So every single, this is why being in the music publishing industry is such a great place to be and to be a successful songwriter. Let's go back to, you know, Sir Paul McCartney. Yesterday is the most recorded song in popular music history, and he gets paid a royalty on every single copy of every single recording that's ever been made of Yesterday, and will continue to do so. So the mechanical right is the right that's acquired from the publisher on behalf of the songwriter for a record label, or indeed anybody, to create a mechanical reproduction of a song and sell it.
Okay, so every time there's a stream,
yes,
there's really three kinds of royalties, really. There's, yeah, there's a, yeah, a record royalty that, yeah, goes to the, yeah, recording, yeah, artist and the label, and then there's the publishing royalties that are split in half. There's the,
yeah,
the,
so,
performance and then the, so, mechanical.
So songwriting royalties under publisher deals are effectively, you're right. There's three types. There's mechanical royalties, there's synchronization royalties or fees, and there's public performance royalties. There are a few others. Print sales used to be quite a big one back in the day, but is less so now. But they're the three big ones. So how does a writer receive royalties from those exploitations of their songs? Well, if I've got a publishing agreement, it would be the publisher's job to collect in all of the income, with the exception of the performing right, which I'll come to in a minute, from the exploitation of a song, and then the publisher will pay a royalty to the writer, and that royalty will depend upon what's been agreed in the publishing agreement. So it's typically stacked very highly in favor of the writer, which is as it should be. So for example, on synchronization fees, the publisher will say to the writer, well, we'll pay you 80% of the fee and we'll keep 20%. On mechanical royalties, we'll pay you 80% of the mechanical royalties, we'll keep 20%. The exception is public performance. And this is where I'm going to turn to Martin, because this is my understanding of it, what PRS does, and I think in common with pretty much every performing rights organization around the world, although the splits might be different, is it says, okay, we have this song and we represent songwriters and we represent publishers. And we know that this songwriter wrote that song and this publisher published that song. And here's a chunk of money. And so we're going to give half of it to the songwriter directly, and we're going to give the other half to the publisher. So that's where you arrive at this defined sort of term of art that we use quite a lot now, which is the writer's share of performance income and the publisher's share of performance income. Well, that's all well and good, but then writers turn around to their publishers and go, well, hang on a minute. You're paying me 80% of the money on synchronization. You're paying me 80% of the money on mechanical royalties. But this chunk of performance income that's out there, for which, by the way, you're not really doing anything. You haven't created it and you're not collecting it. You're only giving me, I'm only getting 50%. How does that work? So what tends to happen in publishing agreements is the publisher will, under the contract, say to the songwriter, okay, we will give you a chunk of our 50% so it matches your royalty on other exploitations across the board. So that's sort of how that income flows to the writer. So going back to your earlier point, Bill, about how much does a songwriter make out of performance income? Well, they make their 50%, but actually most of them will get an additional chunk of the publisher's share as well, sometimes an additional 25%. So
do similar thing. We have co-publishing deals here.
Publishing, I think, Martin, PROs around the world do that. I think sometimes there's splits difference. I think in France, I think writers get 60-40, it's not 50-50, but it varies. And so, you know, that's how that works.
That's how those contracts work. And then the writer share is paid directly to the writer rather than going to the publisher, right?
And importantly, for the writer, especially if they have a significant performance income, if they've been paid in advance by the publisher can recoup that advance against the royalties the publisher pays to the writer. But of course, the writer's share of performance income sits outside of that. So it's not applied to recoup any advances. So, you know, there's an income stream that is always hopefully being paid directly to a writer.
No, so this is a great point. And you made another important verbal word choice there, advance, or I will actually say advance. Just like I would say, I would say Lance instead of Lance, which is where I grew up in Boston. They would say, Lance, hey, how are you? But Lance, you talked about advance, and that's something, Martin, I would like to talk to you about, because sometimes these your competitors here, BMI and ASCAP and others, sometimes will pay an advance to have somebody switch, like to have a songwriter go from one to the other. So I'd like to use that. This is a segue to get into sort of PRS and how you're competing with other PROs, not just in the US, but also around the world, Latin America and so on. And the advance, how I understand it is that you don't really pay advances or minimum guarantees. This would be an advance or advance payment of a royalty to entice somebody to come to your PRO. Is that something that you don't do at PRS?
That's correct. So our advance scheme is for existing PRS members. We can advance, and it's something that's been signed off by our board, at our AGM. We can, under strict protocols, use a predefined calculation method to offer an advance to an existing PRS member. They're not at the level that we hear some of the other societies often offer them at. But our board's position has always been, rather than advancing money out, our key aim is accurate distributions and paying out as much of the revenue that we've collected correctly to the songwriters who have authored those works, rather than effectively playing a similar game to them.
So it's not only the advance, and I think Lance would agree with that by chance, but it is other things too that you do. So for example, like BMI, all of the four big performing rights organizations in this country collect reportedly about $4 billion in the last annual collections, and they divide that, and they represent about 40 million songs combined, all combined. So that's 4 billion divided by 40 million. That's about an average of $100 per song. Of course, some of those songs will be pennies and some of them will be, you know, hundreds of thousands, but that's a lot of money that they're collecting. And when you get an advance, that's based on very solid information on what you're going to get paid. And so it may not be that big of a deal to some people. I know I'm going to get that money anyway. It's just a matter of getting it a little sooner. But there must be other things, like the collection, other things that PRS offers that you can, you're competing with, ASCAP and BMI. For example, how long does it take to get paid? Okay, that's one thing I hear a lot of people complaining about. Geez, I'm waiting 6 months, 8 months longer for this payment, three quarters, whatever it is. How does PRS compare with some of the, with ASCAP and BMI, say, for collections and then paying it out to the writer and the publisher?
PRS operates four main distributions a year. So we distribute in April, July, October, and December, and that's for the majority of our usage. However, as of August this year, we moved to monthly distributions for online revenue. So we now run a monthly for what is, I guess, the most important source of revenue for many songwriters, for the revenues that come from Spotify, Apple Music, and all of your key streaming services.
Well, that's huge. Monthly is tremendous. I don't think that anyone on this side of the pond is doing that. Am I correct about that? I may be wrong.
That's correct. So I think the...
At least ASCAP and BMI are not doing that. Yeah.
So timings depend on various different factors. When the invoice is paid, when the data comes in, whether the money's domestic versus whether it's overseas. And overseas revenue in particular can arrive on different schedules. But with PRS, we run a service called the Major Live Concert Service. That is a service for people who perform and write, performers who write their own songs at venues globally over 5,000 cap. And it's an agreement that we have with all of our reciprocating societies for them to pay that money through sooner and at a reduced admin rate. So that can be as quick as 60 days. So from performance through to actual payment can be as quick as 60 days. Now that we've moved to monthly distributions for online, it can be as quick as 4 months. So services like Spotify are invoiced monthly. So from invoice through to payment, through to process, through to out the door can be as quick as 4 months. I think with ASCAP, as far as I'm aware, based on what they have on their website, I think a January performance would be paid to a publisher in September and a writer in October. So they're roughly 8 to 9 months, according to the data they've published. BMI, it wasn't as clear from the information that's available out there, but certainly for overseas, it states that the revenue will go out between 1 to 2 years after the performance has occurred in a foreign country. So there are different lags depending on revenue type and if it's domestic or foreign.
Well, that is huge. And that's why some very big art songwriters, some of whom are very big artists in on these shores in the United States, have switched. I'm not going to name them because it's not public, but you know some of whom I'm talking about, or all of who I'm talking about, have switched over to PRS. Because you, for one thing, you pay quicker, and then maybe there's some other aspect of it too that you could address. Like some countries have these cultural fees that they will impose, right? In order to, is that something that we can, that you have a different approach than maybe some of the other PROs in terms of getting rid of some of these fees and having the net collection costs be, or the net costs be lower than some of the other PROs?
Yeah, so driving admin rates. So we're a not-for-profit, similar to ASCAP. We're run for our members, by our members. And as I said, the key for us is drive costs down, transparency, get as much money out the door as accurately as we possibly can. So the admin rate is something that's really important to us and continuing to drive the admin rate down. So that online monthly distribution I referred to, that's run via, in partnership with a company that we own with Gamer, Stim, and ourselves. is called ICE, and they do online licensing for all of those key DSPs, so around 60 DSPs in around 190 current territories. They license or issue one invoice, so it's one payment, one file that comes through, and that's what we distribute monthly. But we do that at 8%. So we believe 8% is the lowest rate in the market in terms of online streaming. Our reciprocals,
that's huge. 8% is a great rate. And you're talking about this much simplified system now. We using ICE. There's another one called Mint, which is some others use it. But is that pan-European? That's where you can license in one shot, one bang, you can license all of Europe. Is that just Europe, or are there other territories as well outside of Europe?
So it definitely started as pan-European licensing, and this goes back to the European Commission ruling that option three licensing should be permitted. So that's where a publisher can take back their mechanical right from their MRO and license that directly on a global basis into a particular streaming service. So these hubs originated, and PRS, Gamer and Steam, as I said, launched one called ICE that not only licenses, so can do licensing into a multitude of territories, but can process on behalf of publishers who are doing that licensing themselves. So some of the majors license those rights themselves, but have a partner that helps them process. ICE now goes into territories that are far beyond that European, original European reach. So I think for most ICE licenses, certainly the more modern ICE licenses, typically, Japan would be excluded because they still do blanket licensing. Australia would be excluded because they still do blanket licensing there as well. North America, because the North American is obviously tied up by ASCAP, BMI, CSAC, GMR, and the MLC. But all other territories are pretty much in scope of ICE licenses. So they can go into pretty much anywhere and issue a license to make sure, as I said, one invoice, one statement, one commission rate coming out, and that being paid monthly.
What about Latin America? I just, our last episode, we had John Valdivia, who represents Bad Bunny's label, and also Peso Pluma and Carol G, and we had Nico Urdanola of Shepherd Mullin, who's from Colombia, and he's a music attorney here now, talking about Latin America and how, and it came up that PRS is doing pretty well in Latin America. Is that true? You're picking up songwriters and publishers in Latin America for the rest of the world?
I guess the gospel we've been trying to preach is that there's an alternate way of doing things to what people believe is the status quo. And it's our strong belief that for, I guess, ex-domestic collections, if you bring your rights to PRS, there are multiple benefits that will mean you'll receive more money in the long run and receive it quicker. So our approach to bringing in new songwriters and new publishers has been territory agnostic. We haven't focused on a specific territory. We're looking at trying to spread that gospel everywhere we can. So we've had a heavy focus on the Latin American territories, on the African territories, heavy in Asia. We've got resource specifically based in Mumbai that looks after the Indian market. So it's not just in the States where we've been trying to spread that word. It's a global operation that we're trying to move on.
So if I'm representing a songwriter in outside of the UK and outside of the USA and Argentina or something like that, and the songwriter wants to use PRS, would it be advisable for them to use their own PRO in that, say, Argentina or India or wherever for the domestic, and then use PRS for the rest of the world? Or would you cover the whole world, including their home?
We can cover the whole world. Again, going back to that transparency point, we will always be honest and say, if you gave us the rights for your domestic territory, it means there's going to be a wait by the time they send that money to us and it goes out in the distribution. There's going to be a time lag, but also we'll take a commission on it. And that being the case, it may be better off if that's your highest performing territory and it's your local currency that you stay with your local society. And we would always give that advice because we want to be completely transparent. If someone so wished to bring everything to us, they certainly can. You can split territories out however you want. You can join every society in the world individually if you wanted to. You could have Europe with one society. You could have North America or the Americas with another society. So it's entirely up to the songwriter and or publisher as to how they want to split that out.
So now this is amazing that we've gone this far in this conversation and we really haven't talked about AI, have we? I mean, this is like the only podcast that in America that doesn't talk only about AI, I think, at this point in the music world. But it is, how it comes up for me is if I'm looking to, you know, these blanket licenses, if I have a venue, say, or a store, like a department store, and I want to have a blanket license, or a restaurant, you have to buy a blanket license in order to, here would be with ASCAP, BMI, over there would be with you guys, in order to play that huge catalog of anything from that catalog in that location. And so if the license fee is too high, might I not say, well, I can just use AI music. I'll just get that. It's like a water faucet of artificial music that just comes out. And is that a threat? So many people see AI as being sort of an existential or semi-existential threat to their businesses. Is that something that is a threat? And is there already is a lot of AI in music nowadays. Does PRS have a policy about, well, we won't take, if it has this much, you know, if it's 50% AI, 50% robot music and 50% human, then we'll accept it, or we'll, you know, we'll put it through our system. And is there that already, or is that not really a factor yet? And in this, I open this up to Lance as well. I mean, is AI music, for one thing, it's not copyrightable. Okay, you can't, if it's pure AI music, you can't copyright it. So that kind of kills you right there in terms of, I mean, it makes it challenging to make a business where you have AI music. But there is it's a gray area. I mean, in this country, we have the law is not clear on exactly where you draw the line between human and AI, where you get copyright.
We'll just go back to your first question, Martin. Apologies, I might be treading into your lane here. The fact is that if you run a business and you want to play, you want to have music playing in the background, in the old days it would just be a radio. Yeah, and so, you know, it would come through Radio One or whatever. If you don't want to do that and you're in a business and you want to have music playing in the background, but you don't want to necessarily have to pay for it, well, you've always been able to do that. Because, of course, PRS licenses and ASCAP licenses and BMI licenses are only for the licensed repertoire they control. So, I mean, I act for a number of library and production music providers who own all the rights in their music and recordings. They're not registered with a PRO and they will happily license you those rights to use music for whatever purposes you want. And that's perfectly fine, perfectly legitimate. So to some extent, I think if someone's going to go down that route for music to play in their coffee shop or whatever it may be, then they're going to go that they've been doing that anyway, and AI probably doesn't make a hill of beans difference to PRS Martin in that rather limited sort of example. So I'm not sure that it will necessarily make a huge difference there. I guess if what you're saying is, could someone come up with an AI facsimile or reproduction of a song that sounds like it was written by the Beatles? Yes, but then you can do that. I could do that anyway. I mean, I know from my studio experience, if someone says to me, I want to make a song that sounds like the Beatles, well, it's not difficult to do, providing the song's original. It's very straightforward. So I don't know. I think there are significant challenges for the music industry with AI, but I try to be half glass full about it. And I don't think AI is the existential threat to the music industry that people would have us believe. I'm 62. I've lived through at least four existential threats to the music industry, and we're still here.
No, I'm around your age, and I've been through those as well. In 2000, it was like the music industry is over.
That's not in any way to underplay the potential difficulties faced, which I'm sure you know Martin and his members will be well aware of. So I'm not trying to make light of that by any stretch of the imagination, but I think the AI challenge has probably come in different areas.
You deal with game music quite a bit. And that's a situation where you usually have what we call over here work for hire.
In many ways. So we act for a number of game developers. Mm-hmm. In many ways, it's exactly the same as film score music. You know, you would commission John Barry or Jerry Goldsmith or Bernard Herrmann to write a score and record that score for the film. And that music would most likely be owned probably by the film production company. Not always, but very often the case. Games music is exactly the same. You commission someone to write music specifically for the game. And it's commissioned work. So we don't have, strictly speaking, there's no strict legal concept of work for hire in the UK. We have a similar approach, which is what the CDPA says, which is the act that Martin referred to, which governs copyright in the UK. It says that if you are an employee of a company or an entity and you provide you create music in the course of your employment. And just digressing slightly there is a legal debate as to what is employment, but let's assume it's what we all know employment to be. You know, you are employed by a company. If you create any copyright work in the course of your employment, it's owned by your employer. They own it, unless there's something in writing to say otherwise. Conversely, if you're a freelancer or a consultant, or you're doing music to commission, then you own it, unless there's something otherwise in writing. So what will happen is we put in place a commissioning agreement which says, and providing this has all been agreed with the composer, and there's many ways to skin this particular cat on rights ownership, but by far the most common is we're going to give you a chunk of cash, you're going to go away and create some music, you're going to record that music, and we're going to own all the rights in it. And where things kind of get interesting, particularly for the games industry, because they haven't been doing this as long as the film industry and the TV industry, is that they think they're getting a buyout of all rights. And to some extent, they are. They are getting a buyout of all the rights that the writer owns. But as Martin, I'm sure, will tell you, one of the rights the writer doesn't own, if they're a PRS member, is they don't actually own their performing rights. Those rights have been legally assigned to PRS. That's how PRS is able to do the great work it does, because it can actually go in with a big stick and say, well, we actually own these rights. We're not an agent for a writer. We're not a licensee. We actually own them. So you have to come and get them from us. And most writers will very happily go along with that. It's a very sensible arrangement. But what it means, if you're a games developer, you go, okay, so we own all the rights to music. Yes. But you don't own the PRS, you don't own the performing right. What's a performing right? Well, it's this set of rights. Okay, who owns that? Well, it's the PRS, or it's SACEM, or it's ASCAP. Okay, well, so we don't own all the rights. You own all the rights that you can own, but you don't own those rights. Now, film and TV guys, this is water off a duck's back to them. They know, yeah, we know that, but someone somewhere will have a PRS license. It's either the theatre, or it'll either be the broadcaster, or it'll either be the streaming platform, whoever it is. So that's fine. We don't mind that. But the games guys get quite confused about this, because they go, well, do we have to get a PRS license? And that's actually a very interesting point. Because, and Martin, this is where I'm going to look to you now, because my understanding is that, let's say, Bill Hochberg Games Limited has this fantastic game, but it can't get it onto an app store. It can't get it published through the conventional games publisher. So Bill decides he's going to set up his own website and either sell or download or stream his game from his website. Now, at which point, my understanding, Martin, but please leave it, is Bill needs a PRS license to do that if the music contained in his game has been written by a PRS member. So yeah, where games companies get a little worried is, well, actually, we may have a business where we will exploit our game through our platform. Most don't. Most will go through a Steam or through Sony or PlayStation or Xbox or whatever it may be. And Martin, I don't know what the licensing arrangements are. I would defer to you on that. But that's an issue. But I think it's partly one of my jobs is to educate my clients to say, yes, strictly speaking, there is a set of rights that if you use a PRS composer, you cannot own, but it's not a problem. It's absolutely fine. It's just a question of making sure that at some point there's some licensing in place.
I'll cue that up for you, Martin, but I think that's a fascinating point, Lance, that you make there. And it's because if you're a company and you think you have a buyout, it may not be a complete buyout. And that's also, I think, neighboring rights is the same thing. If it's a,
absolutely. Yeah.
Well, we
yeah.
could go down that rabbit hole, but we won't this time. We'll do it another time.
No.
But that's another, there are a couple of different areas where you think you have a buyout and it's not exactly a buyout. And so, Martin, is that a plus for you? Because I think it's a little bit of a nuance with PRS versus say ASCAP and BMI, that they don't have that assignment. Am I right?
Yeah, it really is, and it's that assignment of rights has really helped us in the past, where there's been formerly broadcasters who've gone down the road of attempting to buy out all of their composers' rights, and the fact that they're vested in PRS has meant that they've been unable to do so, and licenses have still had to be issued, and those songwriters have received the revenue that was due to them for the use of those works. But it also enabled us to become the first society to license Sony PlayStation. So Sony PlayStation's web store is licensed through PRS, so if you're a PRS member, your works are licensable, and it's a significant revenue stream. We license Twitch for the same reason, you know, the game streaming, and we are in long conversations with all other major game providers in the UK to issue licenses there as well. So we think it's a significant revenue stream that still has growth in it.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And not just in streaming and music as part of the game, but Marty, you'll be aware, we have a series of sort of classical and neoclassical concerts every year built in the UK called the Proms. And they take place at the Royal Albert Hall and actually now around venues around the country. And over the last 15, 20 years, it's moved from being a purely quite highbrow classical set of concerts to actually very much more inclusive, musically inclusive. So you will have the music of Quincy Jones would be a prom or whoever it may be. And actually there have been a couple of proms which have been music from games. So you have a full symphony orchestra and a full band playing music from games live to a seated audience. And it's not only is it fantastic because this is music being written by composers who are really good, and it's cinematic in scale, a lot of it. It really is huge. But it you know, people are now going to concerts to listen to game music.
It's unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like we were growing up, it was like the summer of 1985 song on the radio. Now it's like the song in the game for the kids today.
Yeah.
Or the score to a part of the game is like what their summer, what their thing that's going to remind them of this year or this summer.
Absolutely.
It's just absolutely different world.
And I think, the games industry is suffered a sort of some economic issues, as we all have, but certainly prior to the last 2-3 years, let me relate it to the business Sheridan's does. I would say our games section is probably one of our biggest drivers of profitability for the firm now. It's just huge. Just on a quick tangent, sorry.
No, that's
I also
fine.
wanted to point out from a legal point of view why I think the PRS assignment of rights is a good idea is that legally, if you're just a licensee of rights, in other words, you don't own them, but you have the owner's permission to use them, unless that license agreement specifically says that you as a licensee can take action to protect and enforce that copyright, it's challengeable if you try and do that as a licensee. So let's say, Bill, you've licensed some rights of Martin for his songs. I've been using those songs illegally. You come to me, Bill, and say, well, actually, I'm going to sue you for that. My first question to you is, where have you got the rights from? Show me the paperwork. And unless you have a license that says, I, Martin, give Bill the exclusive express right to enforce and protect the copyright, there's nothing you can do about it. An assignment, however, is a transfer of ownership, which gives PRS the ability to go out there and not just do the licensing, which is the carrot, but the stick. If needed, it can go, right, well, this is against the law, and we're going to sue. And they have full enforceability to do that. And I think third parties knowing that treat that licensing structure, sorry, the PRS licensing structure with a good deal more seriousness, because they know actually PRS has the legal ability and the consent of the writers to go and enforce those copyrights.
Oh, so that's another reason why PRS, why the British are coming. Okay, the British are coming. The British are coming. BMI, ASCAP, look out.
I mean, Martin and his colleagues are very friendly people, so I think they only do that at the, excuse me, as a last possible resort. But nonetheless, it's Martin, I think I'm right in saying this, it's in your armory, you can do it.
We can, and yeah. Obviously, again, as a not-for-profit member-owned organization, we have to be careful with how we spend our members' money. So we will only use enforcement as a very last-ditch attempt, and we will always try to go down the compliance route or licensing route first. But to Lance's point, it can sound intimidating that the rights are vested in PRS and that ownership changes hands. But I think another key difference between our memberships and other memberships globally is that you can leave PRS with 90 days notice at any point. Mm. So those rights can be transferred back to you within 90 days. That there are no windows that you have to comply with or have to wait for a specific part of a year to be able to resign at any time of the year. If you're unhappy with the service that PRS has provided, you can withdraw your rights and move them elsewhere. Not that and you wouldn't, but you can.
No, but tying to that and the question of advances, one of the advantages for a writer in PRS not giving advances is it means the term of the writer's mandate can be terminated, as Martin says, on reasonably quick notice. If you've taken a massive great advance from ASCAP and you decide halfway through, actually, I don't like being with ASCAP, well, you've got to give that money back. That money, they're going to want that money back, or they're going to keep you tied to ASCAP until you have recouped that advance. Now, I know there are certain A-list premier artists to whom that doesn't apply, but by and large, that's how it works. So although it's quite nice to be able to get a big chunk of cash up front, if you've been given a big chunk of cash by a company that does a terrible job, you know, it's a bit be careful what you wish for sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, this has been a truly great conversation. And I just want to know, is there anything else that you'd like to touch on that we haven't at this point? Or did we click
I kind of like to hear Martin's views on the AI issue. I think I rather dominated that by the conversation, for which I apologise, because I'm coming at it from the lawyer's point of view. And whereas Martin's at the coalface of actually operational practice a bit more.
Yeah, so I guess there were two points to the question. So, Lance, I think largely from a business perspective, we would agree with what we refer to royalty-free music. That's existed for years, and that's been an option for licensees to take royalty-free music. And while AI may be a threat to some of those companies, we believe in the strength and the breadth of our repertoire and all of those works that flow into PRS via our reciprocal agreements. So if you want popular contemporary music or you want classical music, or the way you're going to get it, if you want recognizable works, is most likely through PRS rather than through a royalty-free network. And I think the second part to the question was around legislation and how we're set up in terms of recognizing AI. So for wholly AI-generated works, where the lyrics and compositions have been created by the computer and there's been no human author, with insufficient human contribution to the work, they're not protected by copyright under UK law. AI-assisted works, so where someone may have used maybe something to help them with a harmony or a melody, or maybe they've used a synth that's been generated by AI, PRS members can register works where AI has only been used as an assistive tool in the human-led composition process and the work satisfies the originality test. So for PRS to meet that definition of PRS is AI assisted and therefore be registrable, it must be sufficient human contribution in the work and it must reflect the originality, creativity, and effort of human authors. But also there's a difference between the UK and the US, and that's that under UK law, the lyrics and composition are two separate copyrights. So I think in the States they're one, whereas in the UK the lyrics and composition are two separate copyrights.
That's correct.
And that means that you could have a work that has AI assisted lyrics, but has a completely original human authored composition. And in those instances, we have mechanisms to enable our members to register the human created part and not recognize the AI part. So effectively, they register it as AI, which then tells us that whatever percentage of that work, let's say for argument's sake, 50%, is not licensable and not payable, whereas the other 50% that was human created is. So that's a relatively recent policy that we have defined. It's obviously taken a long time and lots of debate with government and legislators and all of our members. But I think the American societies have come up with something quite similar in the last week or two. It was announced that ASCAP and BMI have also now determined what their approach to AI assisted and generated works is.
Yeah, I mean, traditionally we have not had that distinction between lyrics and music. It's all been mushed together, and that makes it a lot more difficult to unscramble the egg, as it were. But yeah, well,
What's amusing is in the UK, music is copyrightable in its own right as music. Lyrics are copyrighted as literary works, which basically means that the lyrics of the Spice Girls afford the same literary protection, copyright protection, as the works of John le Carré or Salman Rushdie. It's just so the lovely thing about copyright,
They
which we
are
all
as
love
good.
about, yeah, they are as good. But the great thing about copyright, especially in this country, is it is an utterly democratic process. There is no barrier to copyright arising other than the criteria that has to apply to everything. There's no registration required for copyright to apply, and the law is not remotely interested in subjectively whether something is good or not. It doesn't matter. It's an objective test. So I'm a huge believer in copyright, and I actually think that even with the rise of AI, copyright becomes ever more important because it's low barrier to entry for every creative person. It's a low barrier to entry to get legal protection for their work. They don't actually have to do much. In fact, you could argue they don't actually do anything except make sure that what they do is original.
Well, I think that's great. It's brilliant to have you guys on here. And thanks so much. I think we'll leave it here now.